some folks I used to know, used to smile and say hello. Spin the world and turn the page, entertaining from the stage. But Father Time forever true, loves its own and me and you. Disappear just like the sun when the day is done. World is falling down, hold my hand. It's a lonely sound, hold my hand. We'll follow the breeze and go like the wind, and look for a place where the windows bend. World is falling.
That's
Abby Lincoln, Aminata Moseka, with The World is Falling Down. Ain't that the truth? It's the title track from her 1990 album. Arranged by bassist Ron Carter, and Lincoln is accompanied by Clark Terry on trumpet and flugelhorn, Jackie McLean on alto sax, Alain Jean-Marie on piano, Charlie Hayden on bass, and Billy Higgins on drums. This is Lead Stories. I'm Yatrice Lead. Well, President-elect Donald Trump's cabinet and top staff picks are so far an interesting lot, and a strong indication also of where he and his new administration, and by extension, all the rest of us, are headed come the new turnover. The dream team he has been assembling since winning the election is a mostly white male collection of billionaires, global financiers and corporatists, well-connected political insider retreads, military and intelligence war hawks, and God and country nativists bent on returning America to its values. And a choice group of denizens from the political swamp that Trump has sworn to drain. So, is getting scared yet? You should. Because the signs are already on the wall that we're in for a long, bruising fight against the oligarchs. Question is, are we ready? Well, let's see who some of these people have turned out to be and who will be your new cabinet charting the course of where next you go. We have so far, these people are not confirmed, of course, yet. They have to go before the Senate. And apart from this group, there are about 4,000 other people who are in line for top jobs in the administration. About a third of them will be, about 1,200 jobs, it said, will be requiring confirmation from the Senate. But so far, the people he has selected, who will soon have to be confirmed, Jeff Sessions, senator from Alabama, to be attorney general. Well, there are all kinds of problems with Mr. Sessions, not the least of which is his tendency toward racist remarks and racist points of view. But he is Trump's pick for attorney general. We have Representative Tom Price, who is being pegged for Secretary of Health and Human Services, one of the fiercest opponents of the Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare. And he has his crosshairs. He has the crosshairs on Obamacare, so we know what's coming there. We have Betsy DeVos selected by Trump to be nominated for Secretary of the Department of Education, something that I am particularly watching. She is a philanthropist, a billionaire philanthropist. I'll get to that in a minute. But she is a staunch proponent of charter schools and school vouchers. So we get a clue there of where she is going and where Trump is going with respect to that. Governor Nikki Haley of South Carolina, a daughter of Indian immigrants, he has selected, or he wants to be appointed officially as U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations. Interestingly, she's had no experience whatsoever in this realm. Former U.S. Secretary of Labor, Elaine Chao, who served previously, in fact, she has served under, she was Labor Secretary under George Bush, and she is pegged now to be Secretary of the Department of Transportation. She is married to Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell. She's the daughter of a shipping magnate. So we have her being revitalized or resuscitated to come on board with the Trump administration, if confirmed. Steven Mnuchin, the national finance chair of Trump's campaign, Trump wants to name him Secretary of the Treasury. Well, he comes out of a moneyed past, a very moneyed past at that, having had a career at Goldman Sachs, where he spent 17 years and became a partner of Goldman Sachs. We have Wilbur Ross, billionaire, selected to head the Commerce Department and become Secretary of Commerce. Another billionaire. We have these vacant slots. Trump is still working on choosing Secretary of State, Secretary of Defense, Secretary of Homeland Security, Secretary of the Interior, Secretary of Veterans Affairs, although Sarah Palin is being mentioned as the likely candidate there, as is Rick Perry, the Secretary of Agriculture, Secretary of Housing and Urban Development, Secretary of Labor, Secretary of Energy. These are the cabinet posts that Trump is concerning himself with at the moment. But what is fascinating is that among these people, you have a net worth, according to the Washington Post, you have a net worth greater than the gross domestic budget for Bolivia in terms of wealth. So we have a lot of very wealthy people who will be in charge of coursing our nation, putting it on course for the next 4 years. Mnuchin, for example, who I just mentioned, is said to have a net worth of $46 million. Tom Price, the Health and Human Services nominee, a net worth of $13.6 million. Wilbur Ross, who I just mentioned, a Commerce nominee, $2.5 billion net worth. Betsy DeVos, the person who is slated to head up the education department, with a $5.1 billion net worth. Ben Carson, who is selected to head up the housing and urban development department, $26 million net worth. Jeff Sessions, $7.5 million net worth. So you have a lot of people with a lot of money coming on board. And this is exactly what we had discussed. This is where it's going. We have not just a theoretical setup of an oligarchy. We have an actual oligarchy here, government by very wealthy people who may or may not necessarily have any experience, and this includes Trump himself, in the capacities in which they will serve, but who nonetheless are considered perfect for the job because the inference is that if they were successful and smart enough to make all this money, they obviously have what it takes to do the job. Whatever job they're assigned to, they can find a way to get it done. It's a really bizarre way of thinking of one's entitlement. But this is what we had. In New York City, and this began early, we had for mayor, in the office of mayor, when we saw Michael Bloomberg become mayor of the city of New York, serious money. He did not have political experience as such, but he felt very clearly that his wealth and his success in business were the primary qualifications for running a city. I mean, he convinced himself of that and insisted that the city of New York understand the legitimacy of his conviction. And then we saw him doing from small things to big things, how much sugar you should have on one day, that kind of stuff, regulating to the nth degree to mirror exactly what his likes and dislikes were, what his concerns were, what his priorities were to become the entire city's priorities. A law and order candidate, we saw that under Giuliani, the same idea that as he thinks, so should the country, so should the city be run. And we saw this fascistic fervor go into play in the city of New York, where, I mean, it was just repressive almost to the extreme. And of course, he's online. I thought by some strange thing they might have found out that he really would have been a really big problem being nominated for Attorney General. He was not that successful at law. He was not that successful as a prosecutor. Many of his cases were overturned, but he had other problems as well. But look at what we're facing with here. And it's just in formation. It's not yet final. But even in formation, just since the election, this is what has been put together as Trump's dream team. These are the people who are going to plot the course of the country and whose policies are going to affect us every single day at every level. These are the people. And as you see, most of them have some pretty serious cash. Question. Will people of this level of wealth understand what ordinary people need and will go through? Would they be compassionate about that? Would they have a sense of perspective? What other questions that can you think immediately? You should have at least 10 questions immediately relating to your concerns about how this is shaping up. And we'll get to that in a minute with your calls. But I'm concerned also about how you're shaping up your defenses. Where are our collective defenses against this? It's coming. It's coming. We look at how governments, this is a really good study of how governments are formed. What could their purposes be? What would be the main objectives here? What could we see as major contradictions, major problem areas for us? And therefore, how well situated are we to fight this. It's coming. It's coming. In some cases, it's already here. The United States, and this is where things go global now, we see the U.S. borrowing, and in some cases completely inventing, new ways of governance that primarily have to do not with the general welfare of the people, but with making lots of money for a select class, and that's the oligarchy. These are the wealthy people. So we have no illusions about us. You know, this is what it's going to be. Government by the wealthy. Is it possible that wealthy people can be sympathetic to the needs of the ordinary person? Is it possible that for them to be eminently fair in the way they craft their policies, in the way they identify the priorities of the nation? Do you have faith that they would be able to balance things in such a way that most boats are lifted? Or do you think that this is essentially going to be a situation in which the lines of demarcation between rich and poor are going to be even more exacerbated? We will have even a greater divide between rich and poor. It wouldn't surprise us if that's the direction that this would go, because Donald Trump has indicated that throughout his campaign. I'd like us to talk about that, what we think will happen based on the profiles of the people that he has already selected for cabinet-level positions. And as you know, in the culture of politics, what happens at the top just dribbles down to the lower levels, because each administration has a kind of mindset of its own, a character. In the Clinton administration and in the Obama administration, we saw just runaway corruption. That was the culture. Greed and corruption. A total disrespect for the law. And this applied from the president on down the ranks of the people he selected to be in office. It infected the party, as we saw. The inclination to operate with different kinds of rules that were not legal, but that was the culture. The culture of this administration is shaping up to be the culture of the oligarchy. Wealth is everything, and we should understand that, and we should feel comfortable, by the way, being governed by people who, whether they have experience in their particular area of expertise or not, the mere fact that they have attained financial success in their lives is enough. In fact, it's the number one requirement for us to trust that they know what they're doing. But on the flip side of the coin, even as we understand and dissect this, we also have to figure out what could possibly be our resistance to this. Can we even think of putting this type of administration in check? What will it take? Do we have what it will take to actually be a system of checks and balances against this that's coming? That's the question today. So we'll take a little break here and come back to your thoughts on these questions that are on the table right after this. You're listening to Lead Stories on PRN.FM. We're taking a look on how the Trump cabinet is shaping up, the new government. In fact, the cabinet members are being selected now, and the next round will be presenting them before the Senate for confirmation. But already we see a very disturbing pattern in the characteristics of the people being selected by Donald Trump to occupy certain positions within his administration. We're seeing absolutely a preponderance of white males, a preponderance of major, major wealth. We're seeing retreads from the old Republican Party of yesteryear being revived and plugged into other areas. We're seeing a lot of people being assigned responsibilities in areas in which they have zero experience. And we're seeing also the intention by Donald Trump to kind of run his cabinet and run this collection of people as a kind of football team, as a kind of, you know, his own reality show. And we'll see how he is managing, how he intends to manage these disparate groups that are forming within his cabinet. From Lawrence, New York, Chris, you're on the air.
Good afternoon, Trey.
Hello. How are you?
And hello to the PRN listeners and staff. I'm good. How are you?
Thanks. I'm fine. So what are your concerns as you see how this cabinet is being developed and other positions that Donald Trump so far intends to fill, who he has selected for them? What are your concerns?
Well, let me say this first. My concerns not only applied to Donald Trump, but they were the same concerns I had for Barack Obama. And I could be wrong, but I don't feel like this is some sort of new place he's come to. And forgive me, I'm not deeply, I don't know everyone's name, but as I understand, most of the people from Obama's cabinet, half were Carrie Olson Bush and the other half were straight from Wall Street. And so I don't know how this current situation is any newer than the last, outside of, you know, a white guy sitting in for a black guy. And to your question of what I see coming, I see more of what we've already seen. More foreclosures, more privatization of public institutions like schools, roads, policing. I see the same thing that's been happening, the gap between the wealthy and the poor growing. I don't see anything new. Maybe things will happen in a less politically correct way, but I don't feel any newness to this moment, personally. I'm sorry.
Go ahead, because what I wanted to ask you was what you thought about the resistance to any of this. Are we in a good position there or not?
Well, I don't want to speak for the world at large, but I can use a personal experience to express what I'm thinking. And I would say when we had our last union, we had our last vote for our last contract, right? Now, I'm in Lawrence. You have Nassau. You have Suffolk County. You have some of the guys, they live in Queens. And the cost of living in these areas is astronomical. When I first left my parents' house, I was 18. I had a job making $30,000 a year. I paid my rent, bought food, and hung out. Try that nowadays. The cost of living is so high, yet it was impossible to get more than four people to vote for anything higher than a 1% raise. Even though they are currently experiencing the same increased cost of living that I'm experiencing, the same increased cost for fuel, college for the kids. They're having the same, financial experience that I am, to a degree. By that I mean current expenses, not inherited wealth, but current expenses. And that still wasn't enough to get through that there is an establishment that is kind of forcing us into poverty or stagnating us in a way. They had not even, they couldn't even muster it. I'm not saying we had to go on strike, but they didn't even want to say no. Just no, just out loud in the face of administrators, no. And for that reason, I have very little faith in an actual check or any kind of balance to the current situation. And of course, you see guys at the job, they got their Trump stickers on the car or whatever. And, excuse me, again, I don't know how much of this is, we happen to be in America. The ruling class happens to be white, but the ruling class also happens to be rich. And I think there's a sort of a perversion to power in that you find the same kind of situation in Africa, in Asia, in Europe. They may be black in one place, they may be Korean in another place, but the powerful are corrupted across the planet. And, you know, listen, I'm all for punching up, and if white people hold the power, then we gotta punch up in that direction. But I think the power, the working class or working poor or whatever we're calling them now, the 99%, I think we are in such a state of cowardice. And I'm not talking about fighting people in the street with pipes. I'm just saying voice an opinion out loud that is in your best interest. That I even rarely find. And so I don't think that there's going to be a mass movement that will change this. I think it's going to have to be a smaller, much smaller amount of strong-willed people that by themselves, and it's going to be a lonely fight, they will benefit the rest of this country at some point. But I don't see the masses coming together in a strong way. I don't.
Do you think that there's a remote possibility that although we're seeing what we're seeing, it might just be an anomaly here that this could work and Trump will make it work and we should kind of reserve judgment until we see where things are going rather than what
not.
I just did, which was kind of make a forecast and I don't see that it's going to go in our direction too much.
I mean, you have evidence to back up any special, I mean, you have more, I mean, if you choose a billionaire, you choose someone who fights to privatize schools, you choose someone who benefited from foreclosures. These are the values that his cabinet will hold. This is what they're going to project. This is what they hold internally. This is what they're going to project. This is what they're going to spread. This is who they are. So I don't even know if you're forecasting. I think you're just saying what it is. This is not the future. These people are this today. They're already doing this. They're not going to do it one day, possibly. They've already done it, and they're doing it today while we're talking. They're signing papers and pushing agendas. This is not tomorrow. This is today, which is my point that even while it's happening to us on a large scale, you can't get people to look and go, hey, that's wrong. They won't even just, I don't know, I can even take indifference, but there's not even a, no, that's wrong, he's wrong, they are wrong. And so, no, you're not wrong for forecasting, because you're not, I don't think you're forecasting, I think you're just telling it as it is right in this very moment as we're speaking, this is happening.
What, therefore, do you see in the parties, the Democratic Party and other parties that could play a role? Do you think that they're reserving judgment, or do you think they also are you know, what should I say, falling under expectations? What do you think about that? Because they are or could be a force against the Trump cabinet and the Trumpism. Do you have any feeling about them being effective?
Who is this? Who are we talking about when we say them?
Or the Democrats?
Party? Oh, come on. No, absolutely not.
Why did I ask you that?
Was that a trick question or?
You don't think that they're ready?
No. Not that they're ready. It's not even on the agenda. They're not preparing. There's not some day or some time where we'll get them to that place. That's not how it works. They've already told us how they feel about Trump. Hey, let's give them a chance. Let's have a peaceful transition. So for gays and lesbians, for people who prefer the right to choose, for people who thought that maybe we should have stopped some of these foreclosures, for people who believe in public education, please, just for now, be quiet, because I, Barack Obama, think it's time to give him a chance. A chance to do what? To further my agenda. I sat by while all this happened during my presidency, and I would prefer if we continue to have that happen. I don't know how you could interpret that party in any other way. So I don't think that's even, I mean, it was a funny question to ask, but I mean, I hope, no, let me not even hope. No, I don't think these parties, I'm more on the side of, I don't know how you would label this, but new party, I mean, we should stop thinking reform and change, and it's just the police. The word police, not just the police department, the word police has to go. The word Democratic Party, the party itself, the term itself, it all has to go. It has to be erased and replaced, not reformed, not coddled or what is this? Bernie's going to work on it from behind. The party he was just telling us wasn't doing anything for us, he's now going to go recruit for them? Like, mm-hmm. And like, almost like, you know, what is he saying to us right now? Not tomorrow, but what is he saying today?
Well, Chris, I tell you, you have given us a very serious political science lesson right here today. And it, as depressing as the situation appears to be, I am just enthralled about the idea that you see things so clearly. And I want to thank you for sharing your views.
Thank you for having
great.
Me, but don't be depressed.
No. Don't be depressed. But, you know, it is kind of depressing because you also see what the potential is, or how things can be changed. And it's not moving too fast in that direction. But you have some serious clarity there. And I thank you for sharing that with us today.
Thank you. Have a great day.
Thank you, Chris. From Brooklyn, hello. Eric, you're on the air.
Yes, hello.
Hello.
Hi, I haven't called in a while, but I listen to this show religiously. It's as close to religion as I will get. But
Well, thank you. What are you thinking as Trump is shaping up his cabinet and the messages that you're getting?
God bless people like,
what
God
messages
bless
are
people
you
like
getting?
Chris. No, I'm saying God bless people like Chris because, you know, the clarity with which he's spoken is the same way I feel. And this is what I always try to get to, is that I feel like the reason people are so, you know, alarmed by this so-called new situation we're in is because they refuse to say what he said. They refuse to say no. You know, it's as if Trump is going to put on uniforms and go out brutalizing people. It's as if he's going to send his kids to go out and you know, do all these things that we're afraid of. No, he's going to get the same people that are going to say, you know, we're against this, we don't want this. Just like the same people that were operating for Obama. You know, those were the same people that were against the brutality of the police and the armed forces and all of that. And yes, they stand right there and applaud as they destroy Libya. They destroy Syria. They destroy Yemen. You know? So the situation is that, the way I see it, is that the people are afraid of what they're going to allow to happen. Because of the cowardly nature of a lot of the society, they refuse to even speak against what they clearly see. And it to me is unacceptable that people continue to be, you know, to pretend like we didn't see Obama put all the bankers as right-hand people. We didn't see where Eric Holder came from and returned. You know, we didn't see Timothy Geithner and Larry Summers and all these people that should have been in chains, you know. They became his right-hand people and orchestrated all the theft of the national wealth of this country. You know, we didn't see what Colonel Lawrence, what's his name? Lawrence Wilkerson said, that they dropped so many bombs on places like Libya and Syria that they ran out of bombs. This country ran out of bombs. They used so much of your money dropping bombs on people that they ran out of bombs. So who was thrilled? All the military contractors, Raytheon, Halliburton, they were thrilled. So this alarm at Trump is a refusal to acknowledge what has been going on because it's scary. And confronting it will mean that you will have to change your mind about who you're supporting. You know, this past election demonstrated once again, you have millions and millions and millions of people who will go out to vote for two parties that I mean, you know, wear the same uniforms, do the same things, and pretend, put on a big display of all weird guests. But you see pictures on YouTube and stuff. They sat in each other's weddings. They're at each other's parties. They're laughing together. And now they come on stage and say, oh, we're completely against each other. We do different things. We believe in different things. And you have to be in some kind of fantasy land to believe it and then go out and act on it.
So with this recognition, what are you recommending that we do as a defense?
Well, it begins with what we're doing. It begins with educating. And what I always do is when I hear people speaking about it or when we get it, you know, you engage with people about the protests and everything, I think it's critical that we kind of hammer home, you know, in their mind. It begins with our rhetoric. It begins with what we say, how we you know, we allow them to continue the fantasy. Because if you're going to talk to me about how you've been crying and depressed about Trump, then you haven't been awake. You know, you should have been crying about Obama because he's the one. And you know, Bush and Clinton before that and all of these people, they set the table for a person like Trump to come and feast, you know? So if you don't care about who's preparing the way, for example, one of the big things is the NDAA, National Defense Authorization Act. You know, you say that you can go after anyone, anywhere on suspicion, right?
Right.
So now Trump comes into office, and he suspects everybody. So he's trying to go after everybody who's against him. He can go after you.
But the way you said it, it's absolutely true. But, it was so blunt.
So now he's going after everybody. Who are we going to blame? The person who set the table and gave him the capacity and the law to do it? Or who comes upon the scene and says, oh, I'm just going to feast? So this refusal on the side of the people who claim they're good or who claim they want the better things, to look at the people setting the table is a big part of why we're in this situation. You know, I think those, and I've always said, those are the more dangerous people because Obama knows. He knows that he betrayed everybody and threw everybody under the bus, you know? They know that they stole the wealth of the black economy and the economies of darker people around the world, you know? Under this president, they were able to accomplish more of that. Look at Libya. Look at Venezuela. Across the board. Haiti. You know, you set the table for these predators to come and feed. They come and feed, and they're relentless, you know? And now they're going to feast on this country. So it's up to the people in this country to become less cowardly and actually confront and tell their children, you know, tell their children, tell their brothers and sisters, don't act on what Trump says, because he's not going to put on any uniform and go and do anything to anybody. He will have your kids doing it. Don't let them do it. And that's what it's going to take. And unless people are going to do that, I think it's a futile effort to be out here protesting and all of that. And then you have the same black cops that will return to your community and pretend not see that they're hurting their own people. That's a part of the illusion that it's hard to imagine when it would end. You know?
Thanks so much, Eric, for your contribution today. Very deep.
Oh, here we go.
Very deep thoughts and
analysis. Another depressing act, right?
No, I mean, this is what this program is for, to be able to express ourselves and teach ourselves, one to the other, a thing or two. Thanks so much for calling in. CC from New Jersey, you're on the air.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Eutrice.
Thank you.
Can you hear me? Can you hear me well?
Yes.
Okay, great, great, great. I'll make sure I'm good. I'm going where I have better reception. Again, I want to say that you are so, so, so appreciated, so liked, and so loved.
Thank you.
And you're welcome. And we're so, so grateful for your skill, ability, your talent, the shows that you have been putting on. I have to, this is a call for a second time of acknowledging, and this is not the circus, but you have the greatest show on earth.
Well, I think so, because of the callers. The callers are phenomenal. This is a political science course right here. So what are your thoughts as Donald Trump shapes up his cabinet, and what you see in the immediate future that troubles you about it?
Well, I'm not really troubled, actually. I'm not troubled. This is the greatest, I'll have to say, you have the greatest show on earth, and this is the greatest time on earth for all of us. Unfortunately, what gets our attention in this country, we're an image country, we're following the followers, and we've been doing it for decades. And so here we are now in a place where if we're looking for something to turn up, as it's been said, we've got to begin with our sleeves. Also, what has been said is, if it's to be, it's up to me. The question, or the show I'm going to suggest at some very near future, Eutrice, is the show on how we as a people got here. How did we let this happen? What were we doing? How did we get lethargic? How did we get crystallized? How did we get petrified? How did we get in the golf ball state? So as they say, when you point the finger, three point back at you. Hey, listen, I'm part of this situation. You know, I was just kind of watching and relaxing since I went on the original March on Washington. And just kind of watching things, but naive, detached, aloof, in denial, thinking it was going to be better. And what makes it better? I do. You do. We do. And I learned today from Dr. Cornel West that 21% of the people that voted for Donald Trump don't even like him. But some of the, they like Hillary less. Or they felt some of the things he was saying, or they just wanted something different. Didn't matter what it was. And then I learned that 42% didn't vote. So now that tells me about the not voting piece again, where we've got to make a paradigm shift on that in my mind, because this is important. So I'm going to say that the things that we have time for are the things that work. That are going to work. We've got to come together, you know, tighten up our forces. We take a page out of the Jewish playbook and how they function, how they operate outside the country, inside the country, how they operate in New York and around the United States and Asians as well. And we've got to really unite because we can. These are just one of the things about this oligarchy is that they know the greatest fear is when we come out of the sleepwalk, when we wake up, when we recognize it's our time. And that's what it is. As you know, I'm a student of Lloyd Strayhorn, and this...
I'm a numbers man,
okay? I'm a numbers man. What, the numbers don't lie. They don't lie. This is 2016. 2 and 16 is 18, and 1 plus 8 is 9. Very simple in the phatic system of number. It's the end. The new beginning, officially, will be January 1st, where it'll be one more digit. We'll take it to 19, which is leadership, and it's time for us to lead. We have the power. And Alice Walker's slogan on power is something that should be stated every show, or we should be having it on our mirrors and dashboards and magnets on the refrigerator, is that, paraphrasing, do you know it, you trace by memory? But whatever it is we know that people think that they don't have power. And we do have it, and unfortunately, when we look at Obama, hey, he said the same thing Roosevelt said: "Make me do it." And what was he saying to us? Organize, get yourselves organized, and then I can go to bat for you. I can activate. Otherwise, I got to activate the way the game is going. We allowed money to take over the game and control it. So what else should we be getting? They're just doing what we've allowed them to do. We're the masses. We've got the power. We've got the power. We're not recognizing it. We're not recognizing it, and we're not utilizing it. And that's the bottom line. Bottom line, as far as I'm concerned.
Thank you, sir. A very good instruction that we just got from you. Thank you so much for that. We go to Georgia with Gerald.
Hello.
Hello, Gerald. How are you?
Okay, and you?
You're
Hello,
on the air.
Can you hear me?
Yes. Yes.
I'm just trying. I really want to ask a question. Well, actually, one thing I wanted to say was being reactionary is really not a good thing. But how can you be proactive when you're not necessarily sure what to be proactive for? Because, you know, everything is still in the making. But the question I really wanted to ask was, does anyone think things would be much better if Hillary Clinton had become the president? Would, you know, would the forecast be much better with her as a president?
Well, why don't you answer your question? What do you think?
I don't know. She's been so deceptive over the years. She says one thing and does the opposite. So, I mean, can you trust anything she said she would do? She may do the same thing that
Trump
would
do. But the main thing, though, Gerald, is that she isn't president. So let's establish that as the premise of your discussion and move from there. We know that Trump is, barring some major development, he is the president of the United States.
Right.
What does this mean to you as he forms his cabinet and we take a look at their profiles, we take a look at the culture of the cabinet, the shared culture that they have, and what is likely to happen? We don't know for certain if it will, but it will happen.
Right.
But we can pretty much guess or prepare ourselves for a particular culture that will prevail under Trump. What do you think that culture will be?
Well, we know it's not going to be good. It wouldn't be good with either one of them becoming the president. But we know it's not going to be good with Trump for us. But what can we do? Everybody talks about organizing, but you have the media working, sending out their signals to the masses to not to do anything, but the same thing, just keep buying and shopping and whatever people are told to do by the media. So organizing is going to be rough, but I'm not saying it can't be done, but it's going to be rough. As the gentleman said before me, Obama did say, well, you know, organize and make me do what I need to do for you. And of course, it didn't happen. We didn't organize, but there were no signals coming from him to do that either. So I don't know.
Hello. You just hit the nail on the head right there. He said this specifically to people of color in this country. He did not say that, and he did not maintain that position with any other community.
Okay.
So it means that he has the capacity to recognize an obligation to certain communities, and he also decided that there are other communities who will have to compel him to do something. Other communities didn't have to compel him at all.
Yeah, well, business as usual. We knew that. That's the name of the game. It's the name of the game. We know that this is the position of blacks in this country. We have to fight tooth and nail for everything. But what can we do now? We can't. I mean, when I'm thinking as black people, myself as a black person, and as the whole country that's in this position where we're going to be subjugated to these people. What can we do until they do so? We don't know what to do until something happens, until they take some kind of action. How can we react to this until we know
what they're going to do? You certainly can get prepared.
Okay.
So in the event that something happens, you don't have to first start organizing against it, that you have an organization ready to go.
Right. Okay, great. Which way did we go for that? I mean, there's a lot of organizations, but... which way? I mean, you're right. I agree. I've been hearing that from a lot of different directions, that this has to happen. But then again, which way do you go to start?
You start small, right in your neighborhood, right on your block, right in your family, right in your group of friends. You start. You start somewhere.
Right.
It doesn't matter where you start. But you start.
So, I agree. But I'm just asking questions at this time.
And they're very good questions, Gerald.
Well, thank you. But I'm just saying, he hasn't done anything yet. He probably will. We know that, but we don't know what he's going to do. He may be worse than we think or not as bad as we think.
Right.
But we don't know. So, all right. Well, thank you.
It's like, I live in Florida, and if you live in Florida, everybody knows you have to have at least one flashlight. You just have to. Because we're known for lightning storms and hurricanes and all this other kind of stuff, you ought to have one. You may not need it. We may be lucky not to have a storm ever. But until that happens, you are prepared. You should at least be able to see where you're going in the dark. Because you're going to lose electricity at any time, whether it's the hurricane season or not. Everybody has a flashlight. At least one in the house. I have four. And I've learned it's important to have four flashlights because as you go from room to room, you're going to be able to have your hands close to something that is working in another room. So you have to be prepared and you've got to start somewhere. Start small. But Gerald, great that you would call and offer your thoughts and suggestions today for us to consider. I thank you for that. And that brings us to the end of the program today. Quite a few people didn't get to talk today, but tomorrow, being Free Your Mind Friday, gives you the opportunity to express your views during that time. So be comforted. All is not lost. Stay tuned. Coming up next, Expanding Mind with Eric Davis. You can reach me at leadstories, L-E-I-D, stories at gmail.com. I want to tell you, I can't seem to tell you this often enough, what an incredible group of people you are. And it is it's a joy and a great comfort to me to connect with you every single day. And get down to the business of group thinking and group talking. So thank you for blessing me with your thoughts and blessing each other. with your thoughts. We'll see each other tomorrow. Bye-bye.
So, live for the day and look for a place where the children play. The world is falling down. Hold my hand. Hold my hand. Hold my hand. Hold my hand. The world is falling down. Hold my hand.